Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, last day of May the 31st. Robert Dalek is with us this hour. He has a brand new book. His books are always really good, and he has been getting a lot of attention for this one. Nixon and Kissinger, Partners in Power. It is about the exercise of power by two of the most important practitioners of the art in the 20th century. Kissinger's unprecedented influence as a national security advisor and later Secretary of State. He was kind of a co-president, especially during the administration turmoil over Watergate. I thought that Robert's comments were interesting. He came away from the work on these two men with a greater compassion for Nixon. Nixon suffered. The man was so insecure. As for Kissinger, he went in with greater admiration for him than he came out, because what he came to understand, Dalek says, is how much of a manipulator he was. Robert Dalek has written all kinds of books. I can't remember if we've talked. I think we have talked with him since An Unfinished Life, John F. Kennedy, 1917 to 1963, which was a huge bestseller in this country. He's also quite a Johnson scholar. He's the author of Lone Star Rising, Lyndon Johnson and His Times, 1908 to 1960, Flawed Giant, Lyndon Johnson and His Times, 1961 to 1973, Hail to the Chief, The Making and Unmaking of American Presidents. He's the author of The Great Republic, A History of the American People, Volume 2, Ronald Reagan, The Politics of Symbolism, several books on FDR and American foreign policy. And he writes also for The Atlantic Monthly, The New York Times, and The Washington Post. He's an elected fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and of the Society of American Historians, and served as president of that organization quite recently. We're going to welcome phone calls. We'll have many, I'm sure, for Professor Dalek. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And I should also say that he's taught at these major institutions all over the country. Professor Dalek, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Lovely to be with you.
Yeah, great to have you here. You know, it really is interesting that these guys, you think of them as being so incredibly secretive, and yet there is so much material that you were able to put your hands on that makes this not very secretive at all.
Yeah, it's really quite ironic, isn't it?
Yes.
That this most secretive administration turns out to be probably the most transparent of any presidency in the country's history, at least to this juncture. And it was amazing what they left behind. Of course, there are the Nixon tapes. There are 3,700 hours, and there are 900 hours that are still closed, not out of any intent to hide things, but because the manpower it takes to get them reviewed and opened is still not fully available. But then there's also 20,000 pages of Henry Kissinger's telephone transcripts. He had locked these up in the Library of Congress till 5 years after he died, but the Historical Division of the State Department and the National Security Archive over at George Washington University put pressure on him to open these materials up, and the Historical Office of the Department of State said that we publish the Foreign Relations of the United States. It's a great diplomatic document series going back to 1869. Mm. And they said, we can't publish authoritative volumes without your papers. So he finally relented. What puzzled me is why he left so much in there that that really does is embarrassing to him, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard on the grapevine, after an excerpt of the book was published in Vanity Fair, which does not put him in a flattering light. He was said, someone who told me that he was livid. And I said, well, he has every right to be livid against himself for doing some of the things he did, and for then letting me read all this material, leaving it behind for scholars to see.
Right, exactly. Let's start a little bit. Let's start with Richard Nixon's earlier years. I found it so interesting that this guy who feels so uncomfortable with people, who, you know, he's just he just can't get it. He can't walk very well. He can't speak very well. He has a hard time, you know, being a hill fellow well met. He's just, he's an odd guy in so many ways that he goes into this profession where you have to be shaking hands and making small talk. It just seems to me to be so strange.
Yeah.
Why did he do it?
there is something strange about it. Well, you know, my feeling is there was what I would call politics for him was a kind of vocational therapy. Gave him a kind of outlet for his sense of inadequacy, his need for a kind of a constant reassurance and attention. And Kissinger would constantly tell him what a great man he was, and at one point saying to him, "Mr. President, this country will be dead without you." And he it was so transparent, this flattery, but he needed it.
Yeah.
And, but you're right. I mean, he at one point said, "This job," speaking of the presidency, he said, "This job would be great if it weren't for the people." But he, you know, he on the other hand, what accounts for his success in politics is that he had a very impressive feel for public mood. He could read the public when he ran for Congress, when he ran for the Senate in California. He didn't talk about economics or about people's daily lives. What he emphasized was the communist fear of the time. And he played that card, of course, very effectively, riding it even into the vice presidency. Then later, when he first runs for the presidency, he gets defeated by John Kennedy because it's kind of played itself out. Then when he runs in 68, he shrewdly says that he's going to end the Vietnam War. He understood the country was entirely fed up with it. And Humphrey, being identified with the Johnson administration, couldn't quite make the same promise or bring himself to make the same promise. And so he was very shrewd about striking resonant chords with the public.
Yeah.
But he wasn't, you're quite right, he wasn't someone who liked or enjoyed people.
Yeah. I hadn't realized that he spent those years from, until reading some of your book, that the years from 60 to 68 sort of establishing himself as this foreign policy leader, traveling all over the world.
Yeah, he did indeed, going to Latin America, back and forth to Europe and to Asia. And then, of course, when he gets to the presidency, his focus is hugely on foreign affairs. He says at one point that domestic affairs is a matter of building outhouses in Peoria. You know, he disdains it. Though, of course, it's interesting that he responded to the impulses of the time by setting up the Environmental Protection Agency, tried to put across some kind of major health care reform and welfare change. Those didn't succeed, but he understood that those were high on the domestic agenda. But it was foreign policy that that he was focused on. And above all, he wanted to control it, dictate what was going to happen in the way of the making of foreign policy. And so, as a consequence, he appoints a man named William Rogers, the Secretary of State, who is not very experienced at all in the making of foreign policy. And Nixon does this on purpose because he wants someone there in the job of Secretary of State who he can totally dominate and kind of push to the background.
Yeah. And Kissinger, pretty early on in his time at Harvard, also makes foreign policy his area of expertise.
Yes. He did indeed. And, of course, Nixon chooses him as his national security advisor because Kissinger had established his reputation and credentials as a leading American commentator on national security issues and nuclear weapons, and also he had an identity as Nelson Rockefeller's principal foreign policy advisor. But I think Kissinger, or rather Nixon, also thought that he could control Kissinger and really keep him under wraps. The instruction to Kissinger was he was not supposed to speak publicly to the press, in part because of his German accent, but also because Nixon didn't want him out front. Of course, this changes dramatically over the course of the five-plus years they're in the White House together. And Nixon loses authority and power and influence, and Kissinger gains it. And it had a lot to do with initially the initiative to open the door to China. Nixon agreed to send Kissinger there as his envoy, secret mission. And when it became known, it established that Kissinger as something of a celebrity. And this continued to grow throughout Nixon's presidency. And once Nixon got caught up in Watergate after the 72 election, he was so weakened, his authority was so compromised, that Kissinger essentially took away a lot of the power of making foreign policy.
Yeah. You talk about how smart both guys were, but it's interesting, too, that you look at how they were very thorough in their studies, so that Kissinger would be poring over books, you know, not a social guy. Nixon, when he's at Duke, is maybe going to an occasional game, but he's poring over books, doesn't have much of a social life. Were they smart in the sense that they really absorbed a lot of information, or were they creative, fresh, innovative thinkers?
Well, they absorbed a great deal of information, but they were also thoughtful and in some ways quite wise on certain matters about foreign policy, because what Nixon understood, and he was the one who initiated this, as he put it, you couldn't isolate a country with 800 million people forever, meaning China. And Kissinger really became his instrument in transforming that policy. And they both understood that if they established a relationship with China, it was going to have a significant impact on their dealings with the Soviet Union, which, of course, was their principal competitor for world influence and power. And so by opening the way to a Sino-American relationship, they put pressure on the Soviets, which they respond to, and then Nixon and Kissinger promote this policy of détente. What they understood was that nuclear weapons were not usable weapons, that this doctrine of man, mutually assured destruction, was what influenced them. And they wanted to arrive at some kind of accommodation with the Soviet Union, not in any way any defeat in the United States, but some kind of accommodation with the Soviets so that you could put in place what they called the structure of peace. And this was shrewd and sensible and rational, wise, innovative. So, you know, they know a lot, and they're also on certain things innovative. On the other hand, I see their policy in Vietnam as a disaster.
Yeah, here's a guy who gets, he's got the answer to Vietnam, as you say, the four additional years of fighting cry out for explanation. Could the war have ended sooner? Could the Saigon regime have been saved from itself in a communist takeover by Hanoi? In light of the end results in Vietnam, Kissinger's selection for the Nobel Peace Prize in 73, another point of controversy. What were they thinking? How did this go on for four more years?
And something like 23,000 Americans lost their lives, and tens of thousands of Vietnamese, of Cambodians, Laotians. What were they thinking? They were convinced that they could exercise enough military muscle to push the North Vietnamese not into defeat, but into something what they called peace with honor. That the United States could then escape from this war with kind of honor, with flags flying, so to speak, and it wouldn't be this loss of American credibility. They were very worried that if they walked away from the war too quickly, it was going to undermine, injure American credibility with both allies and adversaries. But what I argue is that they could have ended the war in 69, and it would have enhanced their credibility and America's credibility, because the attitude out there was you are pursuing a failed enterprise. This war is going nowhere for you. You get out of that war, you can marshal and use your resources in much more constructive ways. But they couldn't accept that proposition, and they just pushed then on this idea of going into Cambodia, that Cambodian incursion. They encouraged the South Vietnamese to strike the North Vietnamese in Laos. Then at the end of 72, the Christmas bombing in order to force the North Vietnamese into final agreement. But through all this, they knew that there was no victory to be gained in Vietnam. They talk about it. Nixon says to Kissinger in 69 that there are some people in Saigon who think victory is possible, and he said it's not. It's impossible. And then Vietnamization, you know, remember that?
Sure,
the whole business of sound familiar, they'll stand up while we stand down. I mean, echoes today of this with Iraqization, I guess. But Nixon also knew this wasn't working. In 71, they pushed the South Vietnamese to fight the North Vietnamese in Laos, where they're building up their forces and sending in more materiel to South Vietnam. Well, the South Vietnamese get their heads handed to them, and Nixon is furious. And behind the scenes, you see on these tapes, he curses them. He is ranting. Why can't they take one damn hill? Why can't they capture a few prisoners when they won't bomb North Vietnamese trucks because they are, quote-unquote, moving targets? He blows a stack. He says, it's ridiculous, he says. And anyway, he then Kissinger see this whole business as this Vietnamization is a failure. And then when they finally do get peace, Kissinger tells Nixon, don't call this peace with honor lasting, because what they understand is that it's not going to last all that long. And the North Vietnamese will go in there and beat up on them and probably capture South Vietnam. So, I mean, they're really so cynical about what they're doing there. And there's one conversation which is so disturbing that Kissinger has with H.R. Bob Haldeman, Nixon's chief of staff, at the end of 1970. Haldeman tells Kissinger, the president wants to get out of Vietnam by the end of 71. And Kissinger tells Haldeman, well, he shouldn't do it, because if he does that and South Vietnam falters in 72, it could jeopardize the president's reelection.
Oh, gee. Yeah, so, let's think about that. Let's be motivated by that.
Pardon?
Let's be motivated by that. We gotta watch these guys, right?
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, the kind of political cynicism which enters into this so-called foreign policy making.
Right.
I mean, it's subfused with domestic politics.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Robert Dahlak. His latest book is Nixon and Kissinger, Partners in Power. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, 227-2050, 227-2050. There's been a recent opening of millions of pages of national security files, 2,800 hours out of 3,700 hours of Nixon tapes, and 20,000 pages of Kissinger telephone transcripts made by aides who are listening in on the conversation. And Professor Dahlak says this makes another reexamination of the men and their leadership particularly timely and instructive. We welcome your phone calls. All our lines are open at this time. They won't be for long, I wouldn't think. So many of you may have questions, comments about these two gentlemen, and we welcome your phone calls. 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Robert Dahlak is our guest. His book is Nixon and Kissinger, Partners in Power, just been published. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. And we start our calls with Robert. Hi, Robert.
Hello.
Hi.
I want to ask your guest if he if his book covers anything about Nixon's encounter with the anti-war protesters at the Lincoln Memorial in 1970, a few days after the shootings at Kent State. I know you say Nixon had had problems communicating with people, and from what little I've heard about that incident, it sounded as though it was a rather awkward affair.
Yes. It was indeed, and Nixon, it was like 3 o'clock in the morning. He went out to the Lincoln Memorial. He was so troubled, upset by the reaction in the country to this Cambodian incursion, and of course the death of the Kent State students and some students at Jackson State down in Mississippi were killed as well. And so he goes out at 3 o'clock in the morning, or about that time, and these students are there, some of them actually from Syracuse University, and he starts talking to them about football, about their football
oh,
team.
Oh, brother.
And, you know, and they look at him like, they look at him like he's nuts.
Yeah. I mean,
you know, here they are protesting. It's the middle of the night, and he's almost tearful. He comes back to the White House after that. And people around him said he was really, in some ways, on the verge of a nervous breakdown.
Hmm.
The man was, he had extraordinary emotional resources to keep going. And in fact, I think he thrived on crisis. He kind of almost preferred it. When he would have a success, he would question whether it was real. And as I say at one point in the book, he was the sort of man who couldn't take yes for an answer. And he was. But at any rate, that was a famous episode, and in some ways embarrassed the White House.
Hmm.
And but, you know, was an attempt also of kind of public relations to
mm-hmm.
say, you see, Nixon's not such a bad guy. He's not so isolated from the sentiment in this country, and especially from what these student dissenters are thinking and feeling, and he wants to get this war done with, and he shares their desire for peace, and you know, these were all the messages they were sending out. But of course, after that Cambodian incursion, it just enraged students, and of course, all over the country, campuses were roiled by this, and
right.
some of them shut down.
Right. He was in, tell me about his therapist. I didn't realize he was in, Nixon was in therapy with the same guy for quite some time.
Yeah, well, on and off is my impression. You know, that's one of the untold parts of this story that hopefully eventually we're going to get to. When I did my Kennedy book, An Unfinished Life, I was able to get into John F. Kennedy's medical records, and they were fascinating and highly revealing.
Mm-hmm.
I tried to get into Nixon's medical records, and I was in touch with a man named John Tkach, who is the son of Nixon's White House physician, a man by the name of Walter Tkach, and the son would not give me access to the records. He said they're private, and I'm locking them up in the Nixon library for 75 years.
Oh, my.
So, you know, it's going to be a while before we get to these, and maybe we'll find out a great deal more about what plagued Nixon, what his physical and emotional problems were.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Robert, very much for the call. Let's go to Edith from Madison next. Hello, Edith.
Yes, good morning. As you were talking, Professor Dalek, about Kissinger, it doesn't stand to reason that this would be true, but I have to theorize because I've heard a rumor that Kissinger has insinuated himself now as, or maybe all along, as an advisor to George Bush.
Mm-hmm.
And when I hear what George Bush is saying about victory in Iraq, and this all seems so similar to what you've been talking about that took place in Vietnam with the way the war was going, and that Kissinger advised Nixon not to pull out. The whole thing seems so repetitive, and I'm just wondering, is Kissinger trying, you know, we all know that Bush has chosen terrible advisors in the conduct of the war in Iraq. I mean, everything has been so off base, and here I'm wondering, is Kissinger feeding Bush the same kind of stuff?
I'm afraid so. That's the impression I have as well. And, you know, Kissinger, one of his friends said to me in a conversation I had with him that Henry's problem is he has an addiction to power. He likes being in the corridors of power that way. And one can only imagine what he says about Bush in private as opposed to what he tells him face to face. I don't doubt for a minute that he's encouraging him to stay the course in Iraq. And publicly he said, Kissinger has said, you know, we have to bring some kind of stability to that region. We can't just leave there and provoke instability. But it is eerie how similar this kind of misperception and misjudgment is on Kissinger's part, because, as I think you heard before, I think his judgment on what they did in Vietnam was a catastrophe. And we seem to be repeating it. You know, the great German philosopher Hegel said that the only thing we learn from history is that people never learn. And this seems to be what's going on now with Kissinger and Bush and Cheney and others in this administration. It's really very, very troubling.
It is troubling because people are dying. People are dying.
And
that's troubling. Thanks, Edith, very much for your call. Spend just a few moments, because I always found this interesting. Once he was so completely disgraced, and imagine Nixon leaving the presidency mm-hmm. and the farewell, and what humiliation. Then he wants to become a statesman again. He wants to advise presidents, and he felt slighted when he wasn't asked for his expertise. Tell me about his relationship with Bush and with Clinton, and whether anybody really solicited his advice.
Well, you know, he was largely shunned because he was a failed president at this point, the only president in the country's history to have been compelled to resign. And they don't want to, Gerald Ford and Reagan and the first Bush and Clinton, they're not eager to be identified with him. And in fact, at one point, Clinton has him to the White House and calls him Mr. President. And is ecstatic that, that anyone now would call him Mr. President. So, you know, Clinton strokes him that way.
Mm-hmm.
But he's full of venom toward anyone who is not showing him proper deference. Now, he works very hard to repair his reputation and achieves a certain amount here, because he writes 7 books after he leaves the White House. He travels to China, back to Soviet Russia. Promoting his credentials as a great world leader, a world statesman. And people abroad have much greater regard for him than most people in the United States at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a sad, tragic story, and a sad and tragic mm-hmm. for the United States, because for the whole country, because you know, the question I always pose is, why do we elect people like this and, you know, end up repudiating them, so to speak? And, you know, and the same can be said of the current incumbent. You know, how did he ever get 2 elections, winning 2 elections? There are some dispute that he ever won the first election anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But 8 years in the White House, maybe what it speaks to is that this country does pretty well in spite of the people we put into that office. But not always, but I'm afraid more of the time than we'd like to think.
Yeah. The other two, it's just been a little while on this, too, because some of what they call each other is just amazing. Here are these guys who are supposed to be, you know, this advisor to the president, this important guy, and what Kissinger would say about Nixon and what Nixon would say about Kissinger.
Right.
Unbelievable comments.
Well, yeah, I mean, Nixon was increasingly frustrated by the fact that Henry Kissinger was taking away so much of the spotlight from him.
Mm-hmm.
And he was angered by the fact that Kissinger gained so much authority. Of course, it was in significant part Nixon's own fault as a consequence of the Watergate crisis. And the thing I emphasize most in the book is during the Yom Kippur War, which is in October 1973, Nixon is in the throes of Watergate,
mm-hmm.
and at times he can function effectively. In fact, there's a conversation Kissinger has with Brent Scowcroft, who is his deputy at the National Security Council, in October 73, and Scowcroft calls Kissinger and says, it's 5 to 8 in the evening, he said, there's a week into the Yom Kippur War. He said, the British Prime Minister wants to speak to the President in half an hour. And Kissinger says, Brent, he can't do it we can't do it. He's loaded.
Oh, geez.
And then they agreed that Kissinger will talk to the prime minister that night, and the prime minister will talk to him the next morning, the president. Well, 2 weeks later, the Soviets are very upset at the fact that the Israelis have surrounded the Egyptian Third Army in the Sinai. They're fearful that the Israelis are going to force the surrender of this Egyptian army. And they approach Kissinger and tell him that they intend to send in a paratroop brigade to relieve that army, allow foodstuffs, medical supplies to get through. And the Soviets ask Kissinger to have the United States provide a comparable military force. And Kissinger and Al Haig, who is now Nixon's chief of staff because Haldeman's been forced out over Watergate the previous April, they agree they're not going to let the Soviets go into the Middle East. And so they have a telephone conversation. It's part of these Kissinger telephone transcripts. And Haig says to Kissinger, "Where are you going to meet to, you know, talk about this Soviet danger, threat?" And Kissinger says at the State Department, he's now Secretary of State. And Haig says, "No, no, you must meet at the President's house, at the White House," because he wants to be sure that the press thinks, if it leaks out that they're meeting, the press thinks that Nixon is directly involved in all this.
Huh.
Well, Kissinger says to Haig, "Where's the President?" It's 10 to 10 in the evening, Kathleen. 10 to 10 in the evening. "Where's the president?" And Haig says, "He's asleep." And Kissinger says, "Should we wake him up?" And Haig says, "No." And they talk then a half an hour later, and Haig says to him, "Well, did you speak to the president?" And Kissinger says, "No, I don't want him charging around here." Seven officials, including principally Kissinger and Haig, none of them elected to anything. They meet at the White House.
Oh, jeez.
And they raise the DEFCON. You know, the defense condition, nuclear alert.
Oh, my God.
Only twice in the whole Cold War did this happen. Once during the Cuban Missile Crisis, the second time during the Yom Kippur War. And they do it without Nixon's authority. I searched in the archives. I asked the archivist, and there is no document you can find that indicates that Nixon never signed off on.
Unbelievable. That is quite a story.
They do this, and the next day they have another conversation, and what they talk about is how they don't want the press to think we cooked any of this up, which, of course, is exactly what they did. Now, it succeeded. It succeeded. The Soviets backed down, and when Kissinger finally talks to Nixon, he says to him, "Well, Mr. President, you've succeeded again." And Nixon's delighted. Well, what is he going to do at this point? Fire him?
Really?
He complains, though. I interviewed Brent Scowcroft, and he told me that Nixon repeatedly complained to him about Kissinger's assertion of his power.
You asked the question related to all of this, and you can see why the question would be asked. You say that Nixon's competence to lead the country during the impeachment crisis requires the greatest possible scrutiny. Should they have considered invoking the 25th Amendment to ensure that foreign adversaries did not take advantage of a weak administration?
Yes.
What do you think?
Well, you know, it's a very tough question because it wasn't as if Nixon was totally incapacitated. He was at times in his cups. He'd be drunk. Maybe he, that night when they said he's asleep and they wouldn't wake him up, maybe he was on sedatives. I don't know.
Mm.
That's why it'd be interesting if we could get at these medical records. But he was part of the time incapacitated. My feeling is that if Kissinger, who was concerned about the fact that the country's national security was imperiled by Nixon's, however limited the incapacity, was imperiled by it, why doesn't he go to the cabinet? He's Secretary of State, lead cabinet officer. Go to the cabinet, and you can do this under the 25th Amendment of the Constitution, and raise questions about suspending the president's authority and transferring power to Gerald Ford, vice president. And he doesn't do it. Now, of course, he doesn't do it because Nixon would have seen this as a political coup and would have resisted. And maybe at that point he would have fired Kissinger. for doing this. And so Kissinger wasn't going to jeopardize his authority, his power, by doing that.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, it seems to me such a striking contradiction. And throughout this Watergate crisis, Kissinger tries to save Nixon's presidency. He talks to congressmen and asserts, emphasizes that this is a president who defends national security. He has a strong foreign policy record. We can't jeopardize the country's foreign policy positions by ousting him. He curses the Democratic senators, calls them a bunch of traitor bastards to Nixon in one of these telephone conversations. He's trying very hard to rescue Nixon. In that sense, he's sort of complicit in Watergate. Not that he had anything to do with the initial break-in or with the cover-up, but in the sense that he tries to save Nixon from an impeachment.
Mm. More phone calls in a moment. Robert Dalek is our guest, and the book that we're talking about has just been released. It is Nixon and Kissinger, Partners in Power, just published by HarperCollins. Our number is 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Robert Dalek is our guest. We go back to phone calls at 800-486-8655. Mark is our next caller. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking the call. Professor, two things. One, I remember one of the quotes of Henry Kissinger back in those years was that power was the ultimate aphrodisiac.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of funny. He had kind of a reputation as an unexpected playboy at one point.
Yes, he did. Yeah.
Yeah. And the other thing that I'm interested in is that just the idea of Henry Kissinger, war criminal or not, and I'm thinking specifically with the coup of Allende in Chile and, you know, the secret wars that went into Cambodia and so on. Where do you come down on that?
Well, let me first say that, you know, as far as this reputation as a playboy, I think he cultivated it and was part of the manipulation of his image. Much more important question is the second one about can one describe him as a war criminal. Well, let me tell you what they did in relation to Chile, and and your listeners can make their own judgment. Nixon, Kissinger, Nixon denied forever that they were the principal force in toppling Allende. Now, the National Security Archive at George Washington University has done a huge amount of work on this, and they've exposed the documentary record, which demonstrates, makes it crystal clear that Nixon and Kissinger did everything in their power to first try to prevent Allende from coming to office, despite the fact that he had won a plurality in the presidential election there. He won 34% of the vote. But the tradition in the Chilean Congress was to empower the person who had a plurality. And so they did that despite what Nixon and Kissinger tried to do to prevent it. Once he's in power, they do everything they can up to a point, using financial, economic pressures, feeding money to anti-Allende newspapers and political parties, and they have a conversation after Allende is toppled in September of 1973, and I find it quite fascinating, and it's one of those that Kissinger left behind, which kind of startled me. In this conversation, they say, in essence, well, we didn't provoke this coup. I mean, they didn't authorize it. It's not as if they said to the Chilean military, okay, on such and such a date, you go ahead. We're giving you permission. But there was tacit support for this. They, the Chilean military had no question, Pinochet had no question, where the United States stood on all this. And if he had a question, as soon as this coup was achieved, they made crystal clear to him that they were going to do everything they could to support his regime and to help stabilize it. But in this conversation, Nixon pro-communist government, unquote. Mm-hmm. And then they say, why, if this were the 1950s, the Eisenhower era, we would be heroes. And they say, well, we didn't authorize this. Of course, our hand doesn't show on it, they say. We did support it. We did help create the conditions for it, they say. Now, they deny all that in public. So, you know, they're so deceptive and so dishonest, so to speak, about what went on there. Now, does it make them more criminals? I don't know. I mean, it's no lawyer, and I'd be hard-pressed to try and make some formal judgment on that. But on Vietnam, on Chile, on the Indo-Pakistan War, there were ugly things that went on there. And the records are now available. You know, it's sort of wonderful what these presidential archives do or the national archives do, revealing 30, 35 years later. Sad that we can't know these things at the time. Would that we could be flies on the wall about what's happening with this Bush administration and the Iraq War.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Did you have something else, Mark?
Well, I guess just harkening back to something Edith had asked earlier as part of my original query when I called in. Just I am so struck by the repetition, the pattern that is going on now. And it I feel like we're caught in a really twisted version of the movie Groundhog Day. And, I think the role of Kissinger now that you bring up is fascinating, but I'm also just shocked that the American people have forgotten the lessons from 35 years ago.
Yeah, yeah, well, many haven't. They're here in full force today. And what about this concern about Allende? I mean, is this a heartfelt concern on the part of Nixon particularly, who's made this career on anti-communism back in the 50s, that he's very concerned, you know, the domino effect, we can't let this in close to America, and Kissinger is as well, or is there something else at play here? Why do they care about him?
Well, you know, I think, Kathleen, what went on here was, I mean, I quote some of the things they said, which I find ridiculous. They talk about the possibility that, or the fact they see, that that the Italian Communist Party is going to be emboldened by what's happening in Chile.
Geez.
I mean, you know, it's such a stretch. But I think what operated with them was the anxiety about Castro in Cuba, the establishment of Castro's regime, his connection to the Soviet Union, the Cuban Missile Crisis, and they have this this anxiety that Allende will become a source of socialism, left-leaning governments, impulses, ties to communist regimes in Russia, China. They're full of anxiety that this is what Allende will mean. In fact, there's intelligence coming into them from the State Department saying that Allende is not trying to spread his system or his ideas to other countries. In a way, he was too shrewd for that. He understood that if he tried to do it, it would really provoke the United States. As it was, they were hammering on him. And in a way, I conclude that their policy was really based on misjudgment, because Allende was really very ineffective. And he was probably going to topple of his own accord, you see. And so they didn't need to do what they did, which was to put all this pressure on him, on his government, take away all sorts of financial economic support and support his political opponents, and in a sense undermine America's reputation for non-involvement.
David from Milwaukee, hi.
Yeah, hi. I wanted to ask your guest how the current state of politics with the constant fundraising and then the subsequent return of favors affected the election process that got Nixon in, both with the vice presidency his first time and the presidency most recently.
Yep. Well, you know, I'm someone who thinks we should have public financing of campaigns in this country, and I think this raising of hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars is very corrupting to our politics. And, you know, if you're very wealthy, how democratic is it, you or I, you know, who might make small donations as opposed to some corporation which is putting out tens and tens of thousands of dollars. There's a story in the front page of the, I think it's New York Times this morning, about this Fred Thompson, and what he's assessing is whether he's going to be able to run. And the first measure of this is can he raise the millions and millions of dollars that he will need in order to conduct an effective campaign. So there is something, I think, terribly corrupting and undermining of this democratic system of ours from all this fundraising. And of course, Nixon was very much a part of it, and but he had shrewdly cultivated Republican Party leaders in the 1960s after he had suffered a defeat. He cultivated them so that when he ran in 68, he had a lot of party grassroots support, and but he also had lots of donors who he had accommodated himself to. So I just find it a terrible contradiction. And, you know, I'm someone who says that someday this country will wake up and it will have some kind of greater gun control. I just don't understand the need for handguns. I mean, this idea of a well-armed militia just strikes me as something that is such an anachronism. And also we'll have, hopefully, some kind of campaign finance reform. But I'll be long gone, so...
I hope not. I hope not. Seems common sense to me.
I hope so, too, Kathleen, but I'm not banking on it.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. David, thanks for the call. John from Whitefish Bay, hi.
Hi.
Go ahead, John.
Just two quick comments and then a question. One, I was a student at UWM during that period, 66 to 70. And one of the I was in a writing program, and I remember one of my favorite titles for a poem was all you have to do to win the Nobel Prize is stop killing enough people.
Is stop then, doing what?
Killing enough people.
All you have to do to win the Nobel Prize is stop killing enough people.
Yes, yes.
And the other has to do with there's a great play called Nixon's Nixon with two characters in it, Nixon and Kissinger, which is brutally, wonderfully, insightfully funny. Should you ever run across it.
Yes.
And then the question has to do with the fact that given this connection between Bush and Nixon through Kissinger, the fact that Nixon was an obviously intelligent man who was affected by many, many demons, do you think that that Bush has any demons? And if not, why not?
Well, you know, I and some others talk about this at times. Does this fellow Bush lose any sleep at night? I don't know what his demons are exactly, but what I do sort of sense is that he's unleashed his demons on our country, and it's very, very troubling. I mean, I do think there's something awfully neurotic about these people who run for the presidency, and it's disturbing. They're, as I said at the beginning of our discussion, Kathleen, there's such an impulse to use politics as vocational therapy, as a way to kind of reassure yourself or salve your ego. And now, I don't know if it's possible in our democratic system to get people who are more selfless and detached, you know, go back to the sort of Washington image of I'll only take two terms and I'm really just serving my country. And but there is so much of a self-serving impulse to so many of these folks, and as opposed to, now of course all of them rationalize what they do by saying, well, I'm serving the country, I'm doing this for national well-being, but as we see from so much of the records we get at later on, that their political considerations are so often so very self-serving.
Yeah. Well, you've done it again, sir. Another terrific book. Thanks for all the work you do.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. I enjoyed the conversation. Thanks. Robert Dalek, our guest, and the book is Nixon and Kissinger, Partners in Power. It has just been published in hardcover by HarperCollins. He's written so many other books as well. The book on Kennedy was a huge bestseller, John F. Kennedy, An Unfinished Life. He's quite a Johnson scholar as well. He's written Lone Star Rising, Lyndon Johnson and His Times from 1908 to 1960, and Flawed Giant, Johnson and His Times 61 to 73. He's written a book on the making and unmaking of American presidents. He's written a book on Ronald Reagan and on FDR and many other books as well. Yeah. So we thank him so much for being with us. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing this hour, to John Treader for on-air production. This show will repeat tonight at 10 o'clock in case you'd like to tell anybody to tune it in tonight. Thanks, everybody, for listening. I'll be with you again tomorrow from 9 to 11. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.